Okay, so I'm Peter Acero, and I'm right now I'm a Rutgers University, primarily a philosopher, but I also do film. So we just watched my documentary Love Machine, and we're going to kind of assume you all saw it in our discussion, but we'll try to explain it, and hopefully it'll be fairly self-evident what we're talking about. But it's a documentary that tries to look at the future of the development of a love machine. So not just sort of the sex, but also other elements of the love and relationships. And I'm going to depend on Katie here to ask the interesting questions, and then hopefully I give mildly interesting answers.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks for coming, everybody. Peter asked me to join him today. We've been friends for a year or so. We met in Amsterdam, kind of hit it off immediately, and have a like mind, so I hope we can come up with some fun things to discuss about the movie. I've seen the movie about 3 times now, and I really enjoy watching it, and every time I watch it, I come away with it with a new set of questions. And today, I think my new, what I'm perplexed about today, I'm really going to lose some sleep over tonight, is if I ever have an opportunity to meet Manuel Delanda while he's in a monogamous relationship, have an opportunity to have sex with him, I'm not sure if I should fake an orgasm or pretend that I'm not having one. I like to, with a man like that, you want to stay on the moral up and up.
Yeah, if you faked it, it wouldn't be cheating.
Right. Or if I do fake it, I just have to make sure and tell him that I did. Someone was telling me to have an orgasm just then. It wasn't emergent at all. okay, so what I'd like to sort of bring out today to start off with, to kind of get a sense of where you're going with this film. And by way of sort of harking back to the way that Johannes sort of framed the conference. He sort of closed the question, the manifesto, with the question, how will these technologies alter humanity? And yet one thing that I noticed about the film, and one of the reasons I love it, I mean, it's a fine piece of anthropology, insofar as it really focuses on the sort of production end of technologies for sex engagement. And rather than, say, the consumption end of it. And I was hoping that you might talk a bit about, sort of lay out the landscape of philosophy of technology, philosophy of robotics, in terms of this sort of question of efficacy and consequences, and why it's important to look at production, and sort of, you know, place yourself within that that landscape, if you wouldn't mind.
Okay. Wow, all right, big question. So definitely, yeah, so there's a lot of different aspects of production and reproduction, and I think that was definitely a centralizing theme and actually the instigating theme. When I first, the first idea of making this film came to me when I was visiting a friend in Bloomington, Illinois, who actually operates that Amada sheet metal pressing machine. And I was just staying with him, and he had to go change, in the middle of the night, he has to go and change the stack of sheet metal. It's like a big printer that just prints out these patterns, and then they get cut up and folded later. And so I was in this factory in the middle of the night, and, you know, I'm like, oh, so what are you making? He's like, oh, orgasmatrons. Here's the, you know, this is the piece we make. And I was like, you're making orgasmatrons in Bloomington, Illinois. This is amazing. So, but it was just this beautiful factory, and this system of production that exists in that factory, it was just something I really wanted to capture on film. And I'd been sort of doing writing a review of Moravec's book for Minds and Machines, and was really thinking about like how to critically analyze Moravec. And I mean, he has this very capitalist model about, you know, evolution and markets and the future of humanity and how robots are going to sort of inherit the earth kind of thing. And it's this very sort of techno theology, almost a fetish kind of thing, that this is great, you know, that the robots are going to like be the next generation of humans in a sense. And that's, I mean, a very kind of extreme view, but he's obviously a working scientist who holds this view and sells books on the New York Times bestseller list about this, right? And then there's, you know, I was working in computer science and robotics and sort of knew all these other angles about the both the philosophers and the engineers and, like, what they were trying to do, and I really wanted to sort of tell a story about who these people were and why suddenly, you know, social and emotional robots were so interesting. And there's this theme that sort of started to draw it all together was love, but and sex is such a big part of, you know, what is love and emotion, but it's also about sex. But sex is also, I mean, a lot of what the talks here have been about is sex is pleasure and very much about self-gratification and play. But sex, I mean, culturally has a lot of other signification. I mean, it's about reproduction fundamentally in a biological sense, but then there's all this stuff about relationships and human needs and love, right? And so if you're really going to build a machine that sort of does all of those things, like, what does that mean? And so and even to build a machine that just sort of takes sex out of context and just says it's just for pleasure, then it's, in a way, it's displacing these other roles that sex had in a more holistic system. So reproduction becomes displaced. But it's already displaced in capitalism, that you have these systems of mass production changing our relationship to craft and to the material world and to our experience of that, and that these things get displaced. So the work of making objects is displaced to these systems.
That just, you know, I mean, there's a lot of play in the film around this sort of copy culture, in a sense an industrial mode of production, and sort of you seem to be kind of emphasizing the place of the industrial mode in this. You know, in Delenda's comments about de-skilling, this comes out, but also there's kind of a sort of, you know, we might almost say a fetishization of copy culture in this sort of cinematic emphases in the film. I mean, do you think that that sort of industrial mode is prevalent in this realm, and is that something that you think is going to have a lot of consequences, say, for the kind of questions that Johannes was asking in the manifesto?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think once the systems of production operate, then you become, I'll just throw things around, you become channeled into these systems of repetition and copying, and it changes. I mean, you know, if you look at Walter Benjamin and the art in the age of mechanical reproduction, it's not that art is completely destroyed, but it's fundamentally changed by the possibility of reproduction, and in some ways better, so maybe we don't have this mythology of originality anymore, and we look at other kinds of qualities as being what's important about artistic objects, for instance. But in another sense, like, there's this sort of assumptions about the organic and the mechanical that that there's something, you know, mystical about the organic, and so there's a demystification that would happen in mass production and copying, which, you know, are we threatened with this in regards to sex and love? Like, are we going to lose that organic wholeness? And then what does it mean? How do we reconstruct a concept of who we are in light of that, and what it is to love, and what it, you know, what sexuality is?
Do you have an anxiety about that?
I think, yeah. I mean, I think I have. I share, like, all the perspectives of the people in my film to some degree. Like, I'm worried about, you know, I'm not Catholic, but I'm worried about, you know, what this Monsignor has to say about, you know, should science do everything science can? Like, what do we lose? What do we risk losing? And what does it force us to take responsibility for that we didn't have before? We have new responsibilities with technology that we never had before. And I think that's a challenge that we all have to address. And, you know, and then I have a little bit of that humanist tug of these two women from the Alliance for Childhood who are really, you know, concerned about what happens when you give kids robotic baby dolls. And, you know, it's not their parents spending time with them anymore, where they're playing with playmates. It's interactions that have been programmed by some you know, software designer, or, you know, maybe here in San Francisco, God forbid. So now you're displacing, you know, parenting, you're displacing childhood interactions to, you know, a corporation who's going to make those choices for your child. And you don't, I mean, and, you know, society moves fast. You don't have time to check out every angle of the software to make sure this is really how you want your kid to understand the world. But you have now that responsibility to do that, you know. Like, what's the bright software to raise right. your child with?
Well, I mean, it's interesting to sort of hear you cop to the humanistic aspect of that. I mean, I've wondered if you were, you know, sort of launching a critique of that, or if it was some sense a way to use the, you know, sort of the ethno methods of the people that are working out there as a way of sort of expressing an anxiety that you had in the first place. I mean, it sort of dawned on me, by the end of the film, it reads as though we're looking at a robotics industry, you know, and I mean more in terms of the MITs, the Kismet, the COG, these guys who are doing something that is sort of on its way to the sex industry. But, you know, sort of paying closer attention to what's going on in the film, it becomes clear to me, at least to me, I mean, the feeling that I had was that, in a sense, you have this AI industry, theoretical AI industry, robotics industry, on one hand, and this sort of, Sibian sort of scene on the other hand. One sort of community talking a lot about, you know, agency, intelligence, some of the kind of experiments that I think Lucy Suchman has a really nice critique of this, even sort of anti-symbolic AI folks that are working sort of in the Rodney Brooks realm who are trying to do embodied robotics and really taking the sociality and the embodiment of human intelligence to bear on that. She has a claim that, well, in a sense, this is still a very humanistic project insofar as they're sort of primarily preoccupied with this sort of instrumental cognition and as sort of the sort of end of the line in doing experiments around human-like attributes. That instrumental cognition is sort of where it's at. And, if you then look at on the other side of the sort of aisle about, the interest in pleasure, the interest in orgasm and so forth, the question then arises, well, are these folks not talking about, you know, sexed engagement, the AI folks, I mean, because they presume that sexed engagement is some sort of subset that you would get through achieving instrumental cognition, sort of a very highly rationalized cognitive system, or is it just that they're not interested in sex engagement? Okay, so there's this sort of bridge that needs to be formed, and you do that in a very interesting way in the film by introducing, you have these sort of behind-the-camera questions. Do you think a robot can love a human? So, it's...
Yeah. So I think, there's a lot in that, so I'm going to try to break it down a little bit. So there's definitely multiple communities, and multiple communities of design and invention. So you have the kind of academic roboticists, and then there's even a strong distinctions between the East Coast and the West Coast, and the Carnegie Mellon, I guess, is sort of in the middle. And so there's this sort of, they have their own sort of little debates amongst them, each other, of like how to go about these things and whatnot. And then you have this level of discourse at which they operate about what is intelligence and an emotion. And there is, in another sense, this strange humanism there about how they theorize what it is to be human with psychological models, with theories. And most people would think, well, they're sort of anti-humanist or transhumanist or post-humanist in the sense that they think you can take whatever it is that's human, idealize it, formalize it, and put it into a machine, and that it's there, and that it's basically the same thing, although they have to also sort of police their own language about, okay, it's a model of emotion, it's not necessarily real emotion. But then, you know, then there's the Moraveks who say, well, I don't think there's any difference.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the same thing. But there's definitely other ways in which language and the kinds of ideas and concepts that they work with are a form of policing their sort of disciplinary boundaries, but also their social status and boundaries that, you know, they're at MIT at the AI lab and they're in an ivory tower and it's not appropriate to sort of talk about sex there. Although, like, Gil's a great guy runs the leg lab. He did run the leg lab at the MIT. He didn't get tenure, unfortunately. But on the sort of walk over to his lab and his conversation, he's like, oh, yeah, all the roboticists talk about real dolls and how, you know, if they don't get tenure, they're going to go and, you know, figure out how to animate a real doll and make $1 million, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
But then I sort of ask him on camera, and he's like, oh, you know, who's going to see this? You know, I don't want to talk. Is it, you know, so there's this sense of it's not, you know, appropriate as an academic sort of dispute pursuit. But they think about it. Like, it's somewhere in the back of their mind. And in some ways, I think it's almost... It drives some of what they do because they're driven away from it in very specific ways. Like, they really look at, like, these infantile robots as sort of the model. Like, let's get away from sexuality. Let's, you know, here's this robot it's a baby, so it's not even appropriate to have any kind of sexual thoughts about it. It's just this sort of look at mother-child relationships as a form of, like, intimacy, which is, you know, something like Spielberg fixates on in AI. As well, and as if that's the sort of archetype of love as well, instead of a kind of mature adult love, which involves sexuality, which is problematic if you're going to make a Spielberg film instead of a Kubrick film. But I mean, you can see the remnants of it in the Kubrick film as well, which came out right as I was finishing editing this film. So I was sort of like, oh dear. But yeah, and so then you have the whole sex industry, which is, they would love to have the skills and theories and ability, you know, these students who come out of MIT, like, to go work for them, right, and build these things. But they don't, but it filters down, right? I mean, and those technologies are out there, and once they're out there, they're going to find their way into those industries. And, I mean, we're already, you know, 7 years later, we can see a lot more actual stuff out there. And the AI is a slow-moving field, so I think the robots are going to actually probably move a lot faster in a lot of ways. Like, the technology is really going to pick up in the next few years, I think. There was another part of your question that I'm trying to remember. The language.
Yeah,
the language thing. So, and how do you...
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was kind of the fundamental challenge, I guess, of the film, as a filmmaker, to sort of do justice to both groups and treat them even-handedly and not sort of take sides on the one hand, but also to actually get them to talk to one another in the film. And I think by the end of it, they really do sort of talk to you. And you can sort of talk about love and emotion in these somewhat abstract ways, and they both are willing to sort of engage that and think about the implications in more abstract ways. But, like, yeah, the physical, I mean, there's also the sense that the physical is sort of a low part, right? And, like, the mental is the high part. And, like, mental is okay to talk about in an academic setting, and, like, the physical aspects are sort of less okay. But it's not uniform, because you have, even among the inventors, like, very different relationships to their own work and to how they deal with their own work in a sexual level, physical sexual level. So you have people like Matt McMullen, who invents the real doll, the sculptor, who's like, this is my art, you know, I don't know what people do with it in their own homes, and I don't really want to know, but it's, for me, it's art. And that's what I do. And then you have, you know, Mario Sacito with the claw that just, like, I love this. I'll be, you know, 80 years old. I'll still be as kinky as I am right now. And I'm never going to stop, you know, who's really into it. And Ben Petty, who's, you know, who's way into enemas. And he's just, like, starting a business to, like, make machines to help people give themselves enemas, and you know, so it's like they have this, and then you have the Sibian guy who's barely able to talk about sexuality at all. But yet has this like very deep, and maybe it didn't come through in the clips that I end up using, but he has this very deep kind of concept of like when his machines are out screwing women, like that's an extension of him, so in this weird way that he's, you know, gratifying all these women across the country, and he's really excited about that. But he's not able to talk about sexuality in any kind of juicy, sexy terms. I mean, it's, I make a product, it fulfills a need, and I've been doing that for a long time.
Yeah. Well, I had a little bit of a crush on him, and kind of humble, but very proud of his product. Sort of the technique you used in the film to bridge this gap was to use the trope of love and to use the trope of fidelity to kind of get both communities to sort of talk around this. And I think that's a very effective way of bridging these two communities and getting them to have sort of a conversation together. And for me, I began to sort of ask myself, well, in what sense and sort of what gives love as a trope and fidelity as a trope, so the power to do that, and you know, what can we learn from that power? And then on the other hand, sort of what other kinds of tropes that we might use to talk about sexed engagement are sort of overshadowed there as are. You know, what other kinds of tropes might we think of? Because, you know, this sort of, you know, fidelity is a very sort of, you know, patriarchal concept in some sense. And, you know, there's all, you know, sort of realms of sex engagement that don't involve love. And, you know what I mean? I'm intrigued by the other possibilities, other vocabularies where we might think, particularly with Matt's dolls, you know, to think through where we could go with some sort of human-like engagement with these dolls that doesn't necessarily sort of, you know, sort of force us into this fidelity love business, you know.
Well, let's just say it's a linguistic device that draws on various imagery and so forth to get a point across. A discursive...
Or a questioning strategy, maybe, something like that. So, okay, well, there's a lot there too. So, love. Well, I mean, love is really vague, like in a way, which is useful. That it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, and you can just sort of ask anybody, well, what do you think love is, or do you think a robot can love, or do you think a person can love a robot, and they'll tell you what they think. This is Errol Morris's filmmaking strategy. You sort of let somebody talk for 2 minutes, and then they'll run out of things to say and start to reveal how crazy they actually are. And it's about right. It's about 3 minutes in every interview, and then you're like, oh my gosh, I can't believe they're saying that. But it's going to make a great film. So you can sort of ask these really kind of open questions, and then people can... They bring in all this language and this jargon of how they're theorizing it, and it reveals a lot about who they are and where they're coming from, like how they approach this very vague kind of open question. And then to actually get those things to merge, then you sort of have to get these more focused questions. And I think that's where fidelity sort of pops up. And I can't take full credit for that. That was actually Doug, my co-producer, who comes up with this question during the Mario thing. And it really worked well, so we kept using it. So it was a bit of an emergent discovery of the filmmaking process. But I think it's an interesting one because it brings up some complicated issues around love that help people focus their answers to the question. So there's a sense of transgression. Like if you're infidel, you know, infidelity versus fidelity, that, you know, it's something you're not supposed to do. So there's like, okay, so what's okay to do? What's socially acceptable? And that's kind of one level. And then there's this other sense of, well, the other. Like it has to be a technology that is an other, a foreign being that's not you. That's not just something you're doing. You're not just playing with a machine, in a sense, some kind of glorified masturbation. But there's actually another being there that you're sharing something with, right? And that's because what people say fear through, you know, why there's structures of fidelity is, you know, you don't want people to cheat because then, you know, you're breaking up some kind of relationship, or, you know, then why those relationships are supposed to be there is highly socially and culturally constructed. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of presuppositions about what that is. I mean, and what fidelity means in different cultures is radically different. You know, sort of Margaret Mead and Samoa. And I mean, there's, you know, Coming of Age in Samoa, is that the book? So, I mean, there's very different ideas about what sexuality and fidelity are supposed to be. And open marriages in the 60s and free love sort of changed a lot of that as well. But there's still required in that concept the other. And so then what is the other? And it's if you just sort of ask people, well, what would a robot need? And they sort of start thinking about, well, what a robot? And so you're thinking about the question like, okay, a robot, but it would have to have this or it would have to have that. But if you just say, well, you know, what would the robot need for it to, you know, be cheating if you're in a relationship? Oh, well. And then there's sort of interesting answers, which I didn't, it's when it has an emergent orgasm, right? Or, you know, these kinds of things. And that the other thing that's sort of really funny was that, you know, Daniel Dennett is this, you know, very prestigious philosopher who writes lots of books, including, you know, Consciousness Explained was one of his big books. That he has, and he's a smart guy, and yeah. And he writes these long, complicated philosophical texts. And it, like, his answer in very complicated terminology is all, basically the exact same answer that Carol and Robert, who were here yesterday showing the antique vibrators, they came up with just sort of off the cuff, right? Just sort of, well, I suppose, you know, when we don't know what the robot knows, and the robot knows better than we do, then it's having a real orgasm, and that's, we don't know, you know, it's emergent, it's in there. And, you know, Daniel Dennett's like, well, you know, there's papers from the 70s of Rorty, and it's the incorrigibility of the mental, and that's, so we, essentially it's epistemological. We don't know what's going inside the robot, so we have to trust the robot, and we have to treat it like another, because we don't have access to its thoughts. So, you know, and coming at it from these totally different universes and winding up in the same place, I thought that was kind of interesting and significant.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this definitely shows where you can go anthropologically, and doing sort of anthropological filmmaking, which is the way I sort of think of this, but from using the sort of strategies of philosophy, sort of, you're sort of like confronting these people with thought experiments throughout the whole thing, which is really interesting to see how different communities sort of respond to this thought experiment. But, and it kind of reminds me, I mean, didn't anybody, Elena Dorfman, she's a photographer here in the Bay Area, she did this fantastic photo spread of the several different people who were living with Real Doll, and had an article in, of all places, Marie Claire magazine, which was really good, you know, really good. And I remember when I was reading it, I was one of the things they said in there, they had a man in there who had a doll that lived with him and his wife, and they all, you know, sat at the table and had breakfast together, and he kind of described that, he said he loved his doll, because he knew that she'd never lie to him, you know. So that's a sort of a, almost like a moral, an ethics thought experiment being played out, you know, in the bedroom, as it were. Which is really interesting that these can be brought to bear on the discussions about, you know, with, you know, a lump of, you know, silicone or whatever. It's really interesting. You know, I wanted to if it. How much time do we have going here, Johannes? Do we have a while to go? Because
I would say like another like 5 minutes.
5 minutes or so. I just wanted to read something, because I'd like to engage the audience a bit.
because I think that we have some, you know, people who experiment with lots of different forms of sexual engagement in the audience, and this is a bit from Dan Savage's column, which I love to read. It's a great place for people to sort of publicize their perversions, which is beautiful because then you realize, oh, I'm not such a weirdo. You know, everybody's doing this. I'm a 24-year-old male somnophiliac. I'm turned on by the idea of having sex with a woman while she sleeps. So long as we have a healthy awake sex life, his wife tells him, he can do whatever he wants. But the problem is that when he tries to get her to, when he tries to have sex with her while she's asleep, she keeps waking up and telling him no. So he's asking Dan for how can he solve this problem to get his girlfriend to remain asleep while he enjoys her the way he really wants to enjoy her. Well, Dan Savage's response was Ambien. That was sort of the solution to the problem. But I mean, the reason I bring it up is, well, you know, we can think this is some sort of perversion on the assumption that there's something like love-driven, missionary kind of sex that, you know, is normal and this is a perversion or what have you. But if you sort of open that up and say, well, there are, you know, these range of modes of sexual engagement that are fine in their own right, then you can start to think about alternative vocabularies for talking about robotics. You know, perfectly viable robotics that's not rational, that doesn't say, you know, I'm asleep, leave me alone, you know, or whatever, but sort of gets into that with you. And then the difference between a human and a doll sort of begins to become much more blurry. So one of the things I was hoping we could do with the audience, I mean, I'm sure other people have questions too, but to kind of maybe, if anyone would be willing to talk about their, you know, if they could have a doll, what kind of thinking being would it be?
All right, maybe we should ask the audience. I don't want to have to answer.
I think we could, we make it an empirical thing, like a statistic. So who actually in the odd? It's stupid. If I ask them, they never will raise their hands, I guess.
Or they can bring closer eyes.
Who? That's good. Close your eyes, yes. And then please raise your hand if you actually... Oh, what's the question? Okay, the question would be, would you consider using a sex doll? Have you ever had sex with a sex doll? Close your eyes. Define sex doll. Who would you have sex with, like, something moving or something like... Not moving. Okay. Something with a face. Okay. That isn't human. Yes, and not an animal. I mean, you have a comment because Annalie will be the next guest on stage. You have a comment about this panel here.
Well, I was very excited by the idea of having sex that had with something that had a non-human face, since we were talking about the other. And I mean, you know, I have lots of opportunities to have sex with people that have human faces. So that's not very. I mean, if I were going to have a robot, like, wouldn't I want it to look like Cthulhu or something like that? I mean, that would be awesome. So, I mean, first of all, okay, tentacles, and second of all, it's Cthulhu. So that's. Yeah, I would say, I mean, that's going to be a great market, is going to be sort of non-human creatures, because who doesn't want to do that? I mean, in this room.
I have to add, if you go to monochrome.at/Cthulhu-Goatsea, you'll see a short story. I have to admit, it's a story. It's not a picture. Okay, maybe like one or two questions, because we're pretty late in time. I think you ask the first.
As far as like the artificial intelligence goes, as far as love goes, do you really think it's more reverse engineering to build like a human versus building a robot mimicking human emotions or adapting human emotions? Are we really just trying to create a duplicate of ourselves, or are we actually trying to understand ourselves better and to create something that assimilates what we feel, I guess, works as the components of love? As here's my reaction, here's your reaction, and basically, do you think that this will emerge, like, that the robots will actually have different kinks and, like, it'll want to, like, I don't know, choke us at night? I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah. I think it's probably like the Asimov's three sex laws for robots. Not strangle your human...
Yeah, you got to have a safety word with your robot. Right? Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think when I was making the film, I was really fixated on the idea of android robots and creating very humanoid robots. And this idea sort of borrowed from Moravec that, you know, they're going to be what replaces humans will be the humanoid robots. But I think, yeah, that is definitely right. There's a big market for the non-humanoids as well. And that robots can do a whole lot of interesting things, maybe with tentacles and whatnot, that humans would never be able to do. But in terms of creating a humanoid robot, I think there's a lot of powerful metaphors in there, and there's a lot of scientific concepts in there. So there's definitely within the academic community this sense of building humanoid robots to understand more about human psychology, cognition, how we have to be put together in terms of reverse engineering a human. I'm not sure how effective that is as a method of understanding the human. And I think a lot of what ends up happening is a projection of our specific cultural and historical moment and what we think it is to be human here and now into a machine. And that's what I find really interesting about the machines is how people sort of project what they want the world to be or what they want the human to be in their concept of this machine. And I think that's a very powerful idea.
Okay, and I'm so sorry. Günther is my master of technology, and I'm your master of discourse. So he actually forbids me another question. Yes? You forbid it? Yes. I'm so sorry. So big applause for the panel.